I'm just telling everyone there are a number of possibilities. And right now, for the here and now, we're in this battle zone between 4230 and 3950. And the winner of that battle zone will take the first price, either to the upside or to the downside. And then we see.
Welcome to Wealthion. I'm Wealthion founder Adam Taggart. Several times recently, I've made the statement, all the technical action is bullish, but all the macro data is pretty horrible and getting worse. One of these sides will eventually prevail, and after a pretty fantastic start to the year, the market action is starting to look a little shaky. To get the best sense of exactly what the technicals are telling us right now, we're fortunate to welcome Sven Henrik of Northman Trader back on the program to discuss both his latest macro and market outlooks. Sven, thanks so much for joining us today, all the way from the UK.
That's right. Glad to be with you, Adam. Again,
glad it's always great, Sven, and your beard game is strong today. So I bow down to your beard strength today.
It's winter time over here. It's rough. So,
yeah, and we were talking before we started the camera here. You know, we've been hearing that it's been an unseasonably warm winter in Europe. Sounds like from your experience, maybe not so much.
Don't people go outside? No, we had some cold weather. It's moderating now. Glad spring is coming. Wood chopping season is coming soon, so I'm excited about that.
All right. Well, you're definitely dressed for it. You can't not chop wood with a beard and a flannel shirt like that. All right. Well, look, Sven, we'll get into everything, energy, central bank policy, market technicals, et cetera. But let's start with the question I like to ask you at the beginning of all the interviews you join us for. What's your current assessment of the global economy and financial markets?
Well, we're back to hopium. I think what happened, and I think this is really critical to understand from a both macro and technical perspective, where did we come from? In September, October, we had obviously market volatility. We had new lows in markets. And this was the point where I think we also had peak bearishness in general assessment of the economy and in markets, as yields and dollars had reached really uncomfortable levels. Uncomfortable in terms of the 10-year was, you know, heading towards the 2008 levels. The dollar had ripped higher the entire year, and all that had obviously pressured asset classes across the globe. And it was the tightening. It was, from a market perspective, the major tightening that we've seen in this cycle. And it was right around that time in October when we also started seeing cracks in the system in terms of liquidity. This is the moment when we saw the Bank of Japan intervening. That's when we saw the Bank of England intervening. They all had their own pockets of angst of things falling apart. And that was also the time when Janet Yellen came out and was also getting concerned about liquidity in the treasury market. And folks, that was it. That was when the VIX was done. And since then, and so it's really critical for everyone to understand, this is when, from a market perspective, we saw the peak in tightening. The dollar reversed of a multi-year trend line. The bond yields all reversed dramatically, and lo and behold, equities rose hard from very key technical support levels in context of a bear market. And this is really critical. It's been critical for me all year last year and into this year, is what appeared to be the most controlled bear market ever. We had individual companies, as probably all of you know, blow up left, right, and center. I mean, the drawdowns and the ARKs, the Teslas, the Amazons, Facebook, you name it, crypto, Bitcoin, all of it got hit hard, like we saw in the 2000 tech bubble reversion. In fact, some of the signal charts that we saw were so oversold and so negative, so persistently negative, they rivaled what we saw in 2008. It was fascinating to see. We didn't have the drawdowns that we had of 2008, but this all came together at the same time, which was to say, wow, we're in actually, technically speaking, in a major, major event situation, yet volatility didn't play ball at all. The VIX last year made lower highs, consecutive lower highs with every S&P low. So something didn't smell right. This is when I started, you know, and I got reamed over it at the time when I started flipping bullish, because, you know, here's the bear going bullish in a bear market. What an idiot, right? But it just, all the technicals lined up. And then we had the reversals in the dollar and yields, which were absolutely necessary. And what has happened as a result of this is that financial conditions have eased consistently, persistently since October, radically eased. And that's why we saw this big equity rally. Then we had obviously tax loss selling in late December as people had taken care of their losses throughout the year. That's not unusual either. But even in December, the technicals were lining up for something bullish. I tweeted out this potential cup and handle pattern, which is, it held at the 23 FIB, which was kind of a key level of support. And boom, we got this, along with China reopening, which I think is a really important point from a macro perspective as well. Keep in mind, China intervened as well. They added to liquidity. So all of a sudden, global liquidity, which is supposed to be in this really aggressive tightening path, on a net basis actually went positive, right? And boom, what do you have? You have a major melt-up in equities that were oversold on a technical basis, oversold from a tax loss selling perspective, and boom. And so now fast forward to here, you come from an extreme oversold market condition to now moving towards key resistance levels. This is what happened here in early February. And you, along with this, and this is also typical for any larger bear market, is obviously you get that moment of relief, right? Price drives sentiment. And right, all of a sudden, because the price action is so good and everything is looking maybe perhaps better, because easing financial conditions have consequences, right? You start getting the wealth effect again. People mm-hmm. start feeling better, right? And if people were previously bearish, which they were, because we just saw about $300 billion in short positioning covered here into February, that's when people question their own narratives again, right? And it's kind of the classic pain trade type scenario where you have either shorts that are bearish, or you have underinvested longs that get ripped higher, they're getting forced to cover, and lo and behold, everybody's talking soft landing again. Mm-hmm. Okay. The big shocker to me here, just from observing the central bank space in the last couple of weeks, was Jay Powell. Absolutely steadfastly refusing to acknowledge the dramatic easing in financial conditions we have seen, and insisting that financial conditions have tightened significantly.
Can you explain that?
Yeah, it's a hard one to explain, I suspect. You know, the Fed kind of sheepishly, I got the impression through the various mouth organs on Twitter, tried to say that maybe they're looking at some sort of narrow definition of what that means. Sorry, in terms of, you know, you can argue, yes, you know, they have been raising rates. But if I see raising rates and yields dropping like a brick and mortgages dropping and financial conditions, look at the Bloomberg index, even the St. Louis's own U.S. financial conditions index has dropped off. That's not tightening financial conditions. That's easing financial conditions. And that's why you see the related reaction in equity markets, right?
Right.
And I think I posted a chart on this the other day on Twitter, which was that the St. Louis U.S. Financial Conditions Index never even got to restrictive, okay? It basically just tacked a neutral line at one point and now is reversed back to easing, which is a really odd way to present yourself. On the one hand, as, you know, we're going to be Volcker. Remember, that was the Jackson Hole speech from August. and we're not going to be Arthur Burns from the 70s, you know, to stop and go and have to redo it, to now basically saying, okay, now let's talk about disinflation nonstop, because that's what Powell did during the FOMC conference. I think he mentioned it 10, 11 times, which in context of financial conditions never having really tightened seems an odd strategy to ultimately declare victory on inflation. Now, personally, I've been on the record saying that I expect inflation to come down dramatically. Mm-hmm. And the raising of rates, as aggressive as they have been after they were caught flat-footed and had to catch up, was the right thing to do. The question, though, is, and this is the going to the larger macro in terms of soft landing narrative now, is we are, it's just reality, math reality, we are witnessing the most aggressive rate hike cycle in 40 years into the highest debt construct ever. This debt construct, you and I have been talking about this for years, you know, has been building ever more aggressively so. And of course, the COVID crisis was not helpful in that regard. What happened prior to all the administrations was not helpful to all at all. And the issue is, obviously, we were all able to afford all this, you know, corporations, governments, personal consumers, with rates being low, being at zero. You can run all kinds of debt in that context. But now the game has changed. I mentioned earlier the 10-year yield going up to 2008 levels. You know, in 2008, that the GDP was 60%. Now it's 120%. This is a completely different economy. And the Fed, having raised so quickly, does not know and cannot claim to know what the lag effects are. Lag effects in raising rates is a well-acknowledged fact, okay? Central bank policy works in lag time period, okay? So whatever they did here in the last 6 months of 2022, we won't see the full effects until the middle of this year, later this year, okay? So that's the big unknown. I saw Goldman came out yesterday and said, oh, the economy is poised to handle higher for longer, maybe better than we expected. No one knows. It's a guess. It's an estimate at best, right? So that's the danger that we're all confronted with, because we are in a way dealing with unknown circumstances.
Yeah. And Sven, if I can just add into that, from what I heard from Powell, he mentioned that several times in his speech. He talked about the lag effect, and markets just totally seem to shrug it off.
Yeah, because, you know, keep in mind, it's not only technical stuff and the easing financial conditions that have been driving it, it's the positioning as well. Sentiment is so important in this. I mentioned the $300 billion in short covering. You know, you get moves like this in major bear markets. I mean, actually, what we're seeing now is child's play compared to what we saw in the year 2000. I mean, we had even much more aggressive rallies, you know, 30, 40, 50, 60% on some levels on the NASDAQ, for example. Absolutely insane. Look, I cannot say how this will play out. Okay, there is maybe a chance for a soft landing. Keep in mind, China reopening, I think from a macro perspective, is a big deal. I think we have to respect strength. I saw the FTSE making new all-time highs this week. I saw the DAX had an amazing recovery. In fact, the DAX was one of those indicators that just one had to pay attention to, because that thing started breaking out of a technical descending wedge in October, and it ripped and ripped and ripped. And U.S. indices followed suit. One by one by one, the NYSE, the Dow, then ultimately the S&P and the NASDAQ, which was lagging. Yeah, so we have seen technically very bullish action, and that so far remains bullish, right? And so you have to, you know, if you have a particular macro view, but ignore the technicals at the same time, you're going to get run over.
Right.
And and I've been posting these Northcasts on Twitter as well. That you've been talking about these structure patterns, and now they ripped out, you know. But but now they're getting also to very, very key resistance. And I think what we're now in this phase here is we went from extremely structurally oversold to now structurally overbought. But we have these breakouts. And if these breakouts can sustain and they get defended on a back test, for example, there's still bullish momentum. You know, our clients, I told them at the beginning of the year, we stay bullish until we have some reasons not to be, mm-hmm. you know, be it technically, get more tactical. but I got these larger bullish patterns that point still higher for the first half of the year, right? And then the view was, okay, we can have a major drawdown into the second half of the year if indeed these lag effects are starting to weigh down the economy in a major way. And, you know, if you see all these layoff announcements coming through, while the labor market is still showing strength and signs of holding up, folks, the labor market is always the very last to go. It's deceiving in that sense.
Right.
So the notion to, I don't proclaim to have any foresight, better foresight knowledge than anyone else, but I would just urge everyone to resist the temptation of expressing certainty about what is going to happen, what is not going to happen. You know, the traditionally, okay, if history has any meaning, in order to believe that this is a soft landing, basically most historical precedence has to no longer matter. From, yeah, you know, just start with the Fed.
It has to be different this time, is what you're saying.
on every level, you know, from yield curve inversions, from Fed fund policy. You look at Fed fund policy over the last 50 years. They hike, then something breaks.
Yeah.
And then they cut. Okay. In fact, structural bottoms in a structural bear market don't usually happen until the Fed is deep into a rate cutting cycle. Not at the beginning of a rate cutting cycle.
Right.
Deep into a rate cutting cycle. Now, given what everything that happened with COVID, all the money printing and the controlled aspect of the bear market that I talked about earlier, which, by the way, In January of 22, when I put out the larger bear article picture, I came up with a theory, okay, which was completely speculative, but my view was how would the Fed deal with inflation? And the premise was to say, to let the air out of the balloon ever so gently, meaning a controlled bear market. Now that was just speculative on my part. But then last year, as I mentioned, the lower highs in the VIX, and we didn't have a single massive blow-ups. Yeah, forget right. FTX, and that was their thing. But I'm talking about the larger market construct. There were no panics.
It was a quote, controlled demolition. I mean, it really was just sort of very a slow controlled burn. Yeah,
very controlled. In fact, I saw a lot of comments at the time say, well, you can't have a bear market bottom with the VIX not at least at, you know, 40, 50, 60, something like that. And that's historically true. Forget a structural bear market. Let's look at just market corrections in context of a bull market, like we had many times between 2009 and 2020. And even then, when you had 20% declines or 15% declines, you had VIX spikes going to 42, 52, plenty of times. Not this time. We had, on the one hand, structural signals that were on par or worse than 2008. And we couldn't get the VIX even to get to 40. Was it 38 or something like that? It stopped. And ever right. lower highs. It just didn't make sense. And you were able to trend line this. And every time it tagged it, It was a buy every single time. And if you ignored this, you missed out last year in a big way. I mean, that's just relevance to the market. Whether we agree with it or right. not doesn't matter. It's just what matters what is what matters to the market. And you can either respect it or you can argue with it. But we're here to make money, not to argue with the market, right? That's kind of my philosophy on this. And so in context of then you look at the worst stock bond portfolio performance ever at some point last year.
Yep.
And no panic, no nothing. It's just eerie quiet. The only example I have of the VIX not getting to 40 during a larger bear market was at the initial big decline in 2008. Very weird. It behaved very similarly. So then, you know, there were a lot of comparisons to 2008 last year. But now the market action that I see doesn't fit with that, right? Because then the big counter rallies, they stopped at the 200 MA, and this time they haven't, right? We just busted through all of them, you know? And so, you know, while I can draw all kinds of doom scenarios, and realistically so, saying about the lag effects are still going to bring about a recession, and a very hard one. I mean, just look at the U.S. government. I mean, the interest expense on debt is going through the moon with every rate hike that they're doing. I mean, we're going to probably hit $1 trillion this year just in net interest expense.
Right, which is more than defense, you know, more than the biggest line item in the budget. And you talked about this earlier, that it is a different world now than in past generations from a debt perspective, right? People will say, oh, you know, interest rates were... this is nothing compared to what we dealt with in the 80s or whatnot. And it's like, because we had a lot less debt back then.
It was 30%. Vis-a-vis 120% now. Right. In the 1980s, it was 30%. It's a different world. And it's not only your government debt. It's corporate debt. You know, there's hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars of maturities this year and next year. And
sorry to interrupt, but it's also household debt too, right? We've got record revolving consumer credit at record high interest rates on it.
Oh yeah, it's a winning formula for a future coming near you. No, look. I mean, a lot of this inflation was caused by two factors. One, obviously, the COVID specific supply chain issues. Not their fault. Okay, their fault was to keep printing like mad into this and creating this money supply just excess on everything and the liquidity that came with it, and then reacting really badly to it, meaning way too slow and being completely wrong on what it meant for the economy and everything else and the inflation that came through. That was their mistake, and they still really haven't copped to it in a proper way. Oh, our models
probably never will, but yes, okay.
It is what it is. But now, you know, there is the danger that because nothing has blown up in this controlled bear market, didn't demolish anything, that maybe you get the sense that of complacency.
Right.
We kind of dodged a bullet here and now we can afford to stay higher for longer. The math is pretty clear. You cannot stay higher for longer. You will choke the economy to death. So the rate cuts are coming. It's the question of the when, right, under which circumstances. And maybe in this context, and I'm just totally spitballing here because I'm trying to understand Powell's thinking here. What prompted him from going, you know, I'm going to be Darth Vader Volker here, to all of a sudden forget about it? Let's talk about this inflation and try to present a narrative of tightening financial conditions when they really haven't. I think this is what the market really pivoted off in the last couple of weeks when we had these additional rallies and FOMO chases and short covering, because all of a sudden he didn't seem all that serious anymore.
He said, I don't really care about financial conditions, right? And that's right.
Yeah. That's just wrong if you're trying to fight inflation. So I think, you know, I've been on the train and continue to be on the train. Inflation is coming down, but I am concerned about all these loosening financial conditions, because historically, this is not what you want to see to really nip inflation in the butt. And then, of course, if you got China, which is the second largest economy on the planet, reopening hard, which they are, that may kind of make things a little noisy in terms of the data prints. I guess next week we'll find out a little bit of that, although it's still early in the process. I think just generally macro speaking, you know, even, you know, be wary of soft landing narratives. February 15th, 2007, okay, Fed Chairman Bernanke projected a soft landing for the U.S. economy.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, that didn't happen, okay? But markets, obviously, continued to rally on this into September, made even new all-time highs, okay? I think we all need to be aware of these macro wheels are really slow, and they leave a lot of room for a lot of market action in between before something breaks.
Yeah.
And for example, yield curve inversions, you know, obviously we've seen some of the most inverted yield curves since the early 1980s, right? And if you look at past yield curve inversions, always been precursors of recessions. But you also got to recognize is there is that moment when it uninverts. And that during that period, oftentimes you still see market rallies. It's not until it properly steepens that's when the recession happens, and that's when everything falls apart. So the timing of this is very nuanced and very tricky. I can't predict it. I don't think anybody can. And therefore, I think that's where technicals are our thing. We assess risk reward on that basis, and that helps us to say, okay, we're here. We want to be really bullish. Here, we want to be really bearish, but we also want to be tactical in some gray areas, which will invariably happen.
So I just want to comment on that, Sven. I got 1,000 questions here for you, and I'm jumping a little bit to my conclusion, but you know, we've got our endorsed financial advisors who are on this channel every week with me, and they and many of our guests have been echoing this, that 2023 is going to be like the year of the audible. There's so much going on, so many cross currents, where they're like, it's hard to come up with a strategy that we think is going to survive the year. We're going to have to be very tactical, watching what's going on. We very well may be bearish one week and bullish the next, given what's unfolding. And at a higher level, the message that I'm hearing is, you know, the era of easy passive investing that we got to enjoy from 2010 to 2021 is pretty much over. And that playbook is likely going to be a recipe for losses going forward. You're going to have to be really much more active. And that comes applies to a general portfolio strategy with a financial advisor, but the technical part of the analysis becomes so much more important because, as you say, the macro story can give you a lot of confidence on what's going to happen eventually, but the path in which you take to get there might be completely opposite for much of it, and you can get steamrolled before your thesis is proven right.
Yeah, I mean, there are times when it's pretty clear if you're pressing your luck on the long side, the risk reward is not in your favor. Doesn't mean you have to sell everything. Not saying that at all, but it is a place where you want to generate some flexibility, right? There are market negotiation phases. And the same thing on the sell side. Everybody, myself included, had to learn this the hard way over the years as well. It's hard to avoid being an emotional beast, and it's hard to avoid being influenced by sentiment, not only due to the price action, but by all the noise that is out there. All right. I mean, you go on Twitter and you go, oh my God. I mean, that happens to the best or the most paid in this business. There were people that were from Wall Street that were bullish all year last year that turned bearish in October.
Yep.
Fact. It happened to them, okay, because that's called the capitulation process. And this is why over the years, you know, I just come back to the technicals, is they can help you stay unemotional and unbiased, because you're avoiding the noise. You're looking at what all these charts and signals tell you. And the beauty is, if you have a congruent factors of charts, from index charts to signal charts to what's happening in history, because history matters to these markets. Our search is always not what is going to happen necessarily, but rather what is relevant to the market at any given point in time, and what that indicates in terms of what is likely to happen. We're always dealing with uncertainty, okay? I'll give you one example. This is not to pat myself on my own back, but I had tracked this publicly as well.
Oh, hey, pat away, buddy.
No, it was, I've been so impressed over the last year since QE disappeared, because, you know, when money just flows through the system, someone like me may get frustrated because markets then act in unusual ways. You know,
when there's the thumb on the scale, nobody can tell what the true price is.
There is no price discovery, blah, 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 blah. What I really have liked over the last year since QE ended is how precisely technical this market acts. And not only on the big picture, but also in the shorter term time frame. There was this, at the beginning of January, there was this like rounding action. I mean, we had a bunch of chop right from out of December, and it was just ugly. And I looked at this pattern and I said, well, this is simple. This basic technical analysis, this is the height of the structure. And it pointed to 4016 on the S&P. I think we were like 3800, 3850 or something like that at the time. And it was just doodling, the chop. It was just going up and down and up for weeks, or like 2 weeks or something like that. And then boom, we not only had the breakout, then there's this classic back test where you see the price breakout, come back to the breakout zone. And again, what is relevant? Who's driving these markets, these algos, right? They back tested the breakout and then rocketed it to 4016 straight up, and then pulled back from 4016. I mean, to sometimes get it that right, I mean, it's just from a technician perspective, you go, wow, that is so cool. You know, that's what makes this fun too, right? But then, you know, it's an ongoing journey, right? But what I see is the footprints of the algorithmic trading that's in the market is in place. Because algos are programs and they are rule-based. It's just not nitty-gritty. And so you get to play along with them. You figure out, where are the pivot points? And this is where you can then adjust risk reward if you want to buy, if you want to sell, scale out, or what have you. And so as long as there's no QE in the market, yay, this is the fun environment. You know, when we go back to QE, which I'm sure we will at some point, I'm going to have to reassess all this. But for now, it's the game. Name it.
All right. Well, look, you just did a great job of elaborating on the point I was making, which is in markets, environments like we have right now, it's the active management and the tactical approach that takes a heightened importance, and the technicals take a heightened importance in this general type of environment. But you're even saying, hey, they're even more relevant now because we finally don't have the interference that we've had for so many years in the past.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. And then it's a joy to see, because for years we all kind of complained about lack of free markets. Yeah. You know, and you see it. I mean, especially when you have, I go back to the point of confluence, when you have multiple factors meeting in the same price zone. You know, that's when you get maybe your strongest conviction and say, okay, this will be support because of X, Y, Z, four, five, six factors coming together. That gives you more, that doesn't give you a guarantee. It never is a guarantee, but it, in terms of, because we're all dealing with probabilities.
Right.
And
but
I
gives you a higher confidence.
And say, okay, now we want to at least test alongside. And testing the long side does not mean YOLO, you know, 100% in no stops. No, you still got to risk manage, because anything is a theory until proven, meaning, okay, we see the price zone come to fruition, but then we want to see a market reaction to confirm what the analysis said. And then if you have the reaction, then great, you know, move your stops to flat, let it ride and scale out along the way. You know, that's then the beauty. And then you look at targets and resistance, and then you adjust again. You know, that's part of fun part for me. It's always a puzzle. You're looking at the elements of the puzzle, what's relevant, and then react to it. So ultimately, you know, I don't care where markets go. I care that they move in specific directions and we can partake in these directions as they offer themselves. You know,
all right, great. Well, look, I'm going to ask you to first tell us sort of what you're seeing. You know, I presume your confidence and probabilities is higher in the short term because you're basing it off of today's data. As we go further and further out, it becomes a little bit more projection. So let's start in the short term and then go a little bit longer. So in the short term, we had this oversold, deeply oversold condition we got into near the end of last year. That extended rubber band now has snapped back to the upside. You've said it's beginning to get overbought up here. You talked about, you know, if the technicals, which look bullish, continue, you know, we could still go notably higher from here. I guess my first question is, do you think this breakout has real legs? Meaning, you know, we're gonna be in a different orbit this year than we were last year, or do you suspect that this is more of a bear market rally that will get dragged back down into bear territory at some point?
Okay, let's look at the evidence. One thing I noted, this again, one of the Northcasts I put out earlier this year was XVG. It's equal weight. It's a measure of the market in, not in terms of market cap, like the S&P 500. It's a market cap based index, right? So the big boys, Amazon, Apple, they have all this big influence on right. Weight. But if an equal weight says, okay, here's all the stocks, put them all at the same price, and then see the move on a relative basis. In 2022, if you look at the internals throughout the year, it was terrible. It was weak the entire year, and equal weight was terrible. But then suddenly something shifted dramatically at the beginning of this year. And I posted this little video about how equal weight was getting towards the downtrend line, you know, the downtrend that we had in place in the overall market since the beginning of last year. And all of a sudden it broke out while the S&P hadn't broken out at all. It wasn't even at its trend line. And there was a character shift that said, okay, this is different than what we've seen in 2022. And the question was, is equal weight sending a signal, a leading signal? And we now have the answer. It did. It broke out. Then the S&P followed suit. And as it broke out, like the other example I mentioned earlier on this little rounding pattern on the S&P, the equal weight pulled back tested, didn't even get a full back test of the breakout of the downtrend, and then ripped higher even further, okay? And S&P, NASDAQ, everything followed suit. So if you look at NIAT or new highs, new lows, that's a key indicator. New highs, new lows last year, total disaster on the floor. Couldn't get above, you know, 50%. It was just terrible. It just screamed to 90, 92, 93, 94 vertically. That's a market shift in behavior, in the internal picture of the market. Got to recognize it, got to respect it. And in fact, this vertical move is very much similar to what we've seen at major market lows before. Okay. It's dramatic on the chart. You know, I'll send it to you. You see it. It's just very different. So I look at this and I have to say, okay, I have to respect that something's changed in the market. And for that to completely reverse would have to show a change in behavior. And in equal weight, if that were to roll over now and take the market with it, that would be maybe one of those signals. The second thing is these breakouts that we had of these downtrends. It's significant technically. And it's significant in the sense that, okay, now we've crossed over specific moving averages in the market. We've broken above these downtrend patterns. And yes, while we're getting overbought, the next test that's, I think, totally important for bulls and bears is if now you get a back test, for example, coming from overbought, if that back test holds like it did with equal weight a few weeks ago, then you can argue this has a lot of legs higher. Now, right. I'll make that case.
Can you just give us like what S&P level would you expect the back test to bounce off of if it does hold?
Okay, it depends on the time because it's a downtrend, so it keeps going low. Okay, but I'll just give you some rough numbers in the here and now as we're approaching CPI report this week, in this coming week with OPEX. Okay, if we were to get a down move, you have confluence levels on moving averages. You got the weekly 5 EMA, which is around 4012. You got the monthly 5 EMA, about 4010. Keep in mind, these are all moving because as price moves in index, it'll adjust these things. We got the daily 200 EMA and a daily 50 EMA in this like 3930 to 3950 area. You got the downtrend line in the 3950 area. You also have an uptrend line from the October lows to the December lows. And ironically, and this is pure coincidence, I presume at this moment, but they're all interjecting with each other for February 16th. Don't ask me why. It may just mean absolutely nothing, but I just think it would be absolutely hilarious if we were to hit that at that point. And then obviously, you know, that would be quite a move from 4195 to 3950. Again, I'm not predicting this. I'm just talking about the confluence that is there. If you were to hit that, we would no longer be overbought, certainly not on a short-term basis. We would probably be pretty cooking oversold. And by the way, going back to sentiment, if you all of a sudden draw from 4195 to 3950, I'm just using those general numbers, all of a sudden you would see narrative shift very quickly, right? That's when all of a sudden everybody would become bearish again.
They'd start sweating again,
Yeah, everybody's sweating again, the recession's coming and doom and gloom. And fair enough, if you break below, I would say if you see a sustained break below those levels, then everything would have been invalidated, these breakouts, right? You would say, okay, this breakout was a failed breakout. And I'll give you one specific example, what is maybe supportive of that notion. Okay. And that is, if you look at markets in general on a long-term basis, levels of control, and I talked about this at the very beginning of the year, what did bears fail to accomplish in 2022? Going back to the controlled bear market aspect. Failed to drop the S&P below the yearly 5 exponential moving average. You do not have an extended bear market unless the S&P actually drops below the yearly 5 EMA. 2000, 2008, that's when we had extended bear markets, drop below it, bottom fell out. In other years, you can go back 50, 60, 70 years. Many times you have a larger correction, shorter term bear market that ends at the yearly 5 EMA. It may dip below it into a year for a little bit, but closes above it. And then guess what? You got 2, 3, 4 years of bull market coming. Happened over and over and over again. The other thing bears failed to do, and this was why the October bottom was so critical, monthly 50 MA. Extended bear markets, you may have an initial drop, you may have a bounce above, and then you drop below it. It never dropped below it. That was the low. It was support. And it's in extended bull markets, when you have these dings into the monthly 50 MA and they hold as support, off to the races you go. So in this context, I think every bear needs to understand there has been no evidence in context of this controlled bear market that a real extended bear market has been accomplished because these levels held. Now, the counter argument to this is, and this is why I'm watching as a pivot of control, put this out as well on Twitter, about the monthly 20 MA. I mean, it sounds also simplistic, but yes, sometimes markets follow very simple rules. That monthly 20 MA, which currently sits around 4213, 4230, I use it as a range because the confluence resistance there is the weekly 100 MA. They're both sitting in the same vicinity. And we got very close to it on this rally here in February. We got to 4195, so really in a spitting distance. And like the monthly 50 MA, you can look at 30, 40 years of data. When the S&P is above the monthly 20 MA, it's in the bull phase. And every time it gets dinged, it's support. May dip below it temporarily during the month. You got to look at the monthly closing candle. Closes the month above, it remains support in bull phases. In extended bear markets, and you go back to 2008, you go back to 2000, the counter rallies got to there and then rejected. And that's why this particular market phase is so interesting, because we got over the weekly 50 MA, which often also is lights out for bear market rallies. So that kind of says, okay, maybe this is over for bears.
Yeah, maybe this has got some momentum, some bullish momentum
here.
But
the monthly 20 MA, to me, is like the key measuring stick. And in 2008, it failed. In 2000, it failed. Now, in 2008, it was confluence with the daily 200 MA, which was resistance. Hit it for one day and then fell apart, right? This time, we're over the 200 MA, clearly, as I pointed out. So now, the challenge is for bears to hold the monthly 20 MA, because if you get above it on the monthly close and then defend it as support on any retrace, lights out. That to me is the true, based on historical observation, that to me is the true dividing line between whether it's a new bull market or it's still a bear market, because there's been a lot of talk that the bear market is over. It may well be, but I don't have the evidence of it yet. Okay. So if you close February above, let's say, call it 4230, 4250, if you want to be safe, and you sustain a move above it in March, and any corrective move from there retests that monthly 20 MA and holds support into close, then these bullish patterns that I have could well play out, and they can point to 4,300, 4,400.
All right, that was my next question, so thanks.
Yeah. So I think it's what's happening now here is actually key, because we have this battle zone between the breakouts that are bullish, but a historical resistance point, a monthly 20 MA, still holding as resistance here at this precise point in time. So for bulls to really confirm a bull move, they need to get above the 4230 area. And for bears to invalidate the breakout that just happened, they need to drop below 3950 and stay below 9050. So that's the range right now. I'll just peg it as 3950 to 4230. That's the battle zone. That's the negotiation phase. And this is where we're going to have to see how the macro either supports either one of those notions. And in case you're asking me, if we do break 3950 on a sustained basis, there is a wonderful level of confluence. Let's give everybody a heads up. In October of this year, I have no idea if we're going to get there or not. I'm just saying, if we see new lows in markets, the uptrend line from 2009 to the COVID crash lows in 2020 coincide with the 38.2 FIP retrace from the 2009 lows to the January 21 highs. That level is 32.32 on the S&P, okay? It would be massive confluence support. Also, the February 2020 highs are close by there. So there would be a lot of technical general confluence support to say that may actually be a point of a major rally if we were to get there. So that's part of the journey, is that you want to keep an open mind as to where things are. So if things get really ugly, you at least have reference points to work off and say, okay, this is maybe an area of interest. Now, I'm not saying this is going to happen. I'm just saying that if bears can really defend this resistance point of the monthly 20 MA, we may see this. We may also see it if these bullish patterns play out first. See, this is the challenge for 2023. I've never seen a year where there are so many possibilities. And I think you see that reflected in Wall Street itself. I've never seen such diversity of opinion in Wall Street in terms of price targets. Usually they're all kind of uniformly in one direction. This year, they're all over the map, from 3,200 to 4,800 or 4,700 or something like this. I mean, it's just, it's, you know, the widest spectrum I've ever seen. And I think it's maybe reflective of the larger macro uncertainty that's happening. And I recognize that is, ironically, maybe we see a combination of something of both, which would probably make it the most challenging year for many, because you gotta be stay open-minded as to the possibilities. You know, again, my initial view for this year was bullish first half, and then maybe something really nasty in H2. But I'm not married to that view either. I'm just seeing as a technical possibility. Why is it so interesting to me, the rally in the first half? Because there's actually also a massive trend line that was broken last year. And if we were these bullish patterns to play out, it may actually just tag that broken trend line as resistance. So I'm just telling everyone, there are a number of possibilities. And right now, for the here now, we're in this battle zone between 4230 and 3950. And the winner of that battle zone will take the first price, either to the upside or to the downside. And then we see.
That is great. Sven, that's exactly the type of analysis I love to bring to viewers here. So thank you for laying all that out. And let's agree now, whether we hit the bullish high of 4,300, 4,400, or whether we hit the bearish low of 3,232, let's bring you back on when we hit either one of those to then tell us what you see coming next.
But Sven, you're saying the market can go either up or down. How is that useful?
No. But well, so no, for no, people what? That were furiously taking notes on all these individual, you know, moving averages and stuff you were mentioning, I just want to, we'll do this at the end, but I want to tell people, look, you know, you don't have to follow all these yourself on your own. Just follow Sven. He follows all this stuff every day, you know, every hour through the day. He tweets every couple minutes through the hour, basically.
No, I'm not. I've really toned down my tweeting, actually.
All right. Well, you're definitely one of the more prolific guys out there that I follow, even still. But basically, you know, just follow Sven. He'll be telling you as we get close to each of these key indicators that he's looking at.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I put out the Northcast, because, you know, obviously we follow, you know, for our subscription service, we're very detailed every single day, all the indicators we're watching. But I'm trying to, technical analysis to me is also kind of an educational thing. And I'm trying to keep an eye on the larger journey. And so when I see things of interest that I find interesting, because I'm debating with myself all the time as well, what's the relevance of this? What's the meaning of this? You know, I put out these little short clips and try to raise awareness in terms of what may be shifting of interest. And so that's it's a journey for all of us, right? And I think it's to the extent that we can take advantage of the signals, obviously it's beneficial to us, right? That's the goal in general, to be able to make technical analysis more accessible for more people. Because I think it's often too overcomplicated, and I try to keep it simple, stupid. I learned that from my wife.
I think a lot of us get that message from our wives. But that's one of the things I really respect about you, Sven, and why I love not having you just on the program, but also recommend that people follow you is, you know, it's important to you to not just give folks what you the what you think is going to happen, but to give them the why and to be an educator there out there. Look, I got a ton of questions we're not going to get to, but I have some important themes I want to tick off before we say goodbye here. Hopefully we can keep you on for a little bit longer here. I do want to get to the kind of the rubber meets the road question of, you know, as investors who are watching this and trying just to say, okay, given what Sven's coming, you know, what type of sectors are looking good from a technical standpoint, what are looking toxic, all that type of stuff. But before we get there, I want to ask you to put your macro hat on back for a second. So you basically said, look, technically, there are lots of options, but we seem to be sort of approaching this binary point. I'm oversimplifying for effect here, but where we are likely probably going to have a big break to the upside or a big break to the downside. You'll be tracking that for us on a daily basis going forward from here. With the macro hat on, back to what we were talking about earlier, sort of soft landing versus hard landing. I assume even though you're watching everything, you are still... Your default assumption is what you just said a few minutes ago. Better first half of the year, worse second half of the year. As the lag effect hits, as you know, if you're on the hard landing side, the hard landing hits, et cetera. I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, which is why I'm going to let you react to this. But as you look on the map, you know, again, markets don't always do what we think they should do. But in terms of what you think things should play, the way they should play out from here, how are you looking at the rest of this year?
Yeah, so, you know, and this is maybe where I'm going to be very wrong. And, you know, I like surprises, but, you know, it's hard for me to envision a scenario where the Fed is going to go to 5%+ on the effective Fed funds rate with the global debt construct that we have and stay there for an extended period of time without that producing a recession. May a recession get delayed as a result of China coming on board and we continuing to have the easing financial conditions? Yeah, maybe. But that also then will add to inflationary pressures. There's not been one example where inflation has been beaten without a recession. And that's
a great point. I mean, that's a really big point to underscore.
I don't want to say it cannot be done. I'm just saying it hasn't been done. And some central bankers in other parts of the world have been a lot more honest about that than what we get from U.S. central bankers in particular, because they don't like to advertise a recession. But they don't ever like to forecast one. Ben Bernanke famously in January of 2008 says the Fed sees no recession while we're already officially in one.
In one, yeah.
Okay.
Now that said, to Powell's credit, he did use the word pain, which I was shocked at a central banker would say that.
That was a good CYA. Of course, it's not central bankers that are getting laid off. It's the rest of the population who are now paying for the monetary policy errors that were made, first with inflation, now with job losses. Mm-hmm. Now, to the extent, and this is the Goldilocks scenario. The Goldilocks scenario said, okay, well, companies had record earnings last year. Why? Because inflation price increases they were able to pass on to consumers, and that gave them an extraordinary amount of profits. Look at oil companies, $200 billion in profits for global oil companies because they were able to pass the increases in oil prices to consumers. It's fantastic. Now we're saying, you know, in the manner of having your cake and eat it too, all this inflation is going to come down, but it's not really going to impact earnings that much. It helped on the way up. It doesn't hurt on the way down. That's nice. And the way to get there maybe is to say, okay, we overhired during COVID, you know, after COVID with all the printing, but now we're going to lay off some staff, and that actually helps improve our margins. Fair point, right? So if you can buffer the two out, maybe the impact on earnings is not so great. But then I want to remind everyone, last year were record earnings ever by far.
Right.
And so you're telling me, okay,
And profit margins too. Sorry to interrupt. Yeah, but not just the absolute earnings, but the profit margins were the highest ever.
That's right. And so now we're saying, okay, we just had the worst inflation in 40 years. We're having the highest or the most aggressive rate hike cycle into the highest debt construct ever. And that's not going to hurt earnings at all.
Right.
Okay. You know, it's a nice story.
Fairy tale. I mean,
you know, I was like, okay, no, the danger is that, okay, these companies are laying off people. It's spreading away from tech to other companies as well. And by the way, guys, you know, I've got enough gray hairs, so do you, to know how these business cycles work. When you work at a company and things are good, everybody's friendly, everybody's, you know, team hurrah, rah, rah. But trust me, there is, if you think you have job security, you don't. Okay. When the margin hammer comes and they have to lay off, they will lay off. And we're seeing some of this now, right? There are tens of thousands of people being laid off. And as a result, by the way, you're going to have consumers that are going to curb down their spending, right? And you start snowballing this along with the fact that these very consumers are experiencing, have experienced and continue to experience a massive cost of carry increase in everything. You're going to run into a wall. And this is the infamous moment in yield curve inversions when all of a sudden the recession hits, companies go from moderate job layoffs to dramatic job layoffs. And that's right. The moment then when the Fed goes, holy shit, we have to cut rates. Okay. And we can do this very quickly. But again, lag effects, because then it takes a while to stimulate the economy back up. And that's my concern in general, that I think we're all in the dark in terms of how this is going to play out. So I find myself in this really awkward position because I see what's happened technically. I'm pleased to have seen it technically from a risk reward perspective. I see the breakouts, but I also see the negotiation phase, but I don't know the when and where. And it's really uncomfortable to say, okay, I see bullish patterns that can take me to 4,300, 4,400, but I also see this macro wall staring us in the face,
right,
which has so much downside risk. And that this is where it gets really hard this year, I think, to say, okay, here is where I want to be really bullish, or here is where I want to be really bearish, because I think we can all get jerked in every which way.
Great. Can you speak to this process? Because this is the question I was getting to, which is, when do you play to the technical versus discounting because of the macro, right? It's got to be hard.
It is very hard. And you know, now that, for example, we got overbought in a major way, and we got really close to that historic pivot of the monthly 20 MA as resistance, you know, our view was, okay, you know, it's been a great run. Let's scale out a bunch of longs and try something on the short side. But then we also know where these confluence support levels are, and then see how that shakes out and then adjust again, right? This is the testing phase to say, okay, now do we re-add long? Do we close out the short? You know, how does this play out? There's clearly uncertainty involved in that. And we have to keep watching the data that goes along with it over time. You know, are the easing financial conditions still part of the makeup? I'll give you one indicator, has nothing to do with technicals and macro. Last year, lo and behold, I also look at seasonality charts just for giggles. And there is these presidential cycle seasonality charts. And last year was a midterm election. You know, it doesn't give you the precise levels at all, but it gives you directional flows. And up until December, it played beautifully, absolutely beautiful. And December was a bit off because we had the tax loss selling because it was a bear market.
Right.
But in terms of directions, it was bang on. So then I looked at this year, which is a pre-presidential election year, right? The next U.S. presidential election is in 24. And this thing has a very specific seasonality, which is, guess what? It just flies out of the gate in January. It is aggressive in February, has a little dip in February, makes another high, goes higher in March, goes higher in April. Pain trade with hardly any dips in between. And so I'm just looking at this, you know, holistically and say, okay, it's playing. It objectively is playing, which tells me, yeah, these bullish patterns can really play out as long as this thing plays. Now, right, if I start seeing it deviate, then I can say, okay, maybe it's no longer relevant to this market because, you know, it seems odd that the market behaves in the same way every single cycle and ignoring everything else. But then look at the VIX this year up until we got to these resistance level and structurally overbought. This year, every Friday, the VIX got crushed. Like no matter what happened in the world, VIX went down in March every single time. I pointed that out yesterday. I said, you know, but here's maybe different because the VIX may be breaking out and boom, we just got the VIX breakout. And so maybe it's different now. But that's what I'm saying. You just got to keep an eye on various factors and test your own thinking. Okay. I've been on that side too, where I've, you know, said, this is all stupid. We shouldn't be even trading up here. But it kept going higher. This is called fighting the tape.
Yep.
This is, you know, this is probably the biggest lesson for all of us. You know, the world is as it is, not as you want it to be, yep, especially when it comes to markets. Okay. And this is why I'm becoming ever more chart oriented more than anything else. Because look, I get it. And I got it in October and I got it in December. Anyone that makes the big bearish macro arguments, I'm philosophically totally behind you. I get all the reasons, okay? And makes total sense. But that doesn't mean I want to miss a 20% rally. I don't. And I certainly don't want to fight a 20% rally, which is kind of right, what we've been seeing. Like NASDAQ, absolutely mad. You know,
the short, there's been such a big short squeeze in the past, you know, week or two, right? Where these guys have just been getting their faces ripped off at the beginning of this year.
Especially when you have these air pockets, like tax loss selling in December, it's artificial selling because people want to blow out their position, take the tax loss. And then beginning of January, I put out this video about these tech charts, Tesla, Amazon, any of them, they all had positive technical divergences. Why would you stay short that? That's crazy. I mean, look at Tesla. It just blew up 100%.
Yeah, if you were short Tesla a month ago, you're dead.
You're massacred. This is again what also happened in larger structured bear markets like 2000 to 2003. You had these massive rallies. You got to be flexible. You can't be stubborn. You may be right 3 years from now, but
it doesn't matter if you get killed on the way, right? Hey, and Sven, if you could just take a second and talk about as you're playing the opportunities that are in front of us, whether you agree with them or not, right? You have to have a risk managed approach to it, right? And that's a big part of what you do, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the big thing, and also a hard lesson I learned, there were times when I wanted to be super bearish and just have shorts on, or super bullish and not have any shorts on. And over time, I've come to realize, you as strongly convicted as you may want to be, extremes can become ever more extremes. You got to account for the unexpected in that regard. So last year worked really well for us with the following strategy that, okay, like at the beginning of the year, we had a strong short conviction. But then while we are always focused on swing trades, meaning we want to hold positions for a longer period of time and then scale out along the way, we also want to take advantage of the tactical in between. Doesn't mean we're day trading, but if I, for example, just a basic example, if I, and shorting, by the way, it's not for most people, and it's harder than buying, stops up processes, right? But even on the short-term time frame, especially when we have these big moves, 100 handles up and down. Look at the other day with Powell, right? Up 70 handles, down whatever. Right. It can move extremely fast. But when I see them, okay, so let's say I have a short on, it's hypothetical, and it's running down, great, wonderful, right? But then I see on the shorter term time frame, I see some positive signals. While I may still have a longer view target of where the short may be going, I'm also happy to close out some of it and even have a hedge long on at that point, or vice versa, for a counter move and then scale out of it. That helps maintain utmost flexibility. It's also discipline to say, I'm not going to be stubborn about a move. I don't need to max out every move. That's right. Idiotic. No one can do that. Yeah, and if they claim to, fair play to them, if it's true. No, I think we all need to have an active approach. We need to have a disciplined approach that is signal based and that respects the signal. Now, I may scale out on a long or on a short, and I may be too early to do that. I have no problem with something. You don't need to be A in every move, and you don't need to max out every move. I think if you apply a technical discipline along the way and say, okay, this was a good technical decision to close out some or to reduce some risk, then that's a good process because it keeps you flexible. You don't want to be in a position where you completely erase all gains because you had a view of where this should go, but then it didn't.
Right. And if I can interject, your focus here as the trader is not to optimize a particular trade. It's to optimize the process, right?
Exactly. And over the long term, that process yields the results. It's steady. It's reactive and it's rule-based. So you don't YOLO into every trade, right? And we've seen a lot of that bad behavior over the last couple of years. It looks glorious, but I don't
see. And every trader posts their one YOLO trade that made it, right? They don't post all the other ones that blew up in their face, right? So thanks for going into that, because I really wanted people to see what a truly experienced professional trader, how they think, how they operate. All right, so I'm looking at the time here. I've got a ton of questions, but I got to limit it to two. Okay. And then we're going to be back on when we hit one of your targets there. So the first
maybe,
one
maybe
is
never.
Just,
maybe we never hit any of the targets. We just chop for 3 years.
We'll still have you back on, even if that happens. But it is true. Chop is a potential outcome here, right? As we're just range bound.
Absolutely.
Which is, if you're a good technical trader, you can make a lot of money in a chop market, right?
It's an awesome trading environment. I mean, I forget the bull bear debate. It's just an awesome technical trading environment right now. The ranges are awesome. It's nice. It's what we want.
You know, I just interviewed Thomas Thornton, who's a former hedge funder and trades his own portfolio. He put in a return of 53% last year. He's not guaranteeing he's going to do the same this year, but he's saying he loves this market for the same reason you do. Just for his process is one that does great in a range bound market.
Yeah, and by the way, I'm not saying, you know, our process is the best process, or, you know, there's only one process. I think people need to identify their process, see what works for them, and then just execute on it. You know, I mean, I'm comfortable with what we're doing.
Because you've honed it over years and years and years, right?
You know, try it and test it, you know, seeing it work, seeing it not work, adjust, move on. And again, it's a simple statement to me, but it's just, it doesn't matter what I think. It's what I see evidence-based is relevant to the market, and then act on it based on what the assessed risk reward probability is, and then execute. And that's the other thing about technical trading. And this is really important. You can identify potential patterns, for example, that suggest a certain market movement. You can identify it. You got to know when it's actually confirmed and when it's no longer active. You got to know when it's invalidated as well. Because you cannot trade yesterday's pattern that's no longer valid. Sorry. This is how you're going to get your head ripped off. Okay. So this is where, again, technical analysis allows us to be unemotional and objective to say, okay, now this pattern is triggered. And as long as it now does this, it stays valid, which then generates a price target, for example. Okay. But if I'm looking at a potential pattern and it never triggers, then why am I trading it?
Right.
You cannot do that. It's dangerous. You need to have confirmation, right? And but just final note on this. This is where also gets really dangerous, because I see these runovers. You know, like for example, we had this last couple of weeks, we had this really nice rising wedge build on the S&P. It was a clean trend line. And in the last couple of days, it dropped below it once, got saved, two, got saved. So if people try to sell that break, they get their heads ripped off, because you're doing it at the point of where it's not confirmed.
Right.
Okay. But then the break comes, right. Then you have the confirmation, like we just had this week. We had a break in an uptrend line, but there were multiple failed attempts. So from my perspective, the better risk reward is to do it at the top of the pattern, not at the point of breaking down, because that's the more dangerous part. So that's just kind of lessons learned over years and reading the tape, I suppose.
Well, and it's gold from being able to leverage the experience of others' standpoint. But your point is, your underlying point is a very key one, which is that technical analysis helps you answer the key Kenny Rogers question about when to know when to hold them and when to know when to fold them, right? You know, you take the guesswork out of it and make it a much more data-driven decision. Okay, so I want to end on a big red stake question for you. But before we get there, let's get to the question of, okay, we've got regular people, regular investors who are watching this, and they are trying to figure out what to do this year. Given your current reading of the tape as it is, are there any particular asset classes, sectors, et cetera, that you're looking at that are saying these seem poised to move in some notable way, shape, or form, either up, down, flat, whatever?
But we're mostly focused on...
Our interview with Sven will continue over in part two, which will be released on this channel tomorrow as soon as we're finished editing it. To be notified when it comes out, subscribe to this channel if you haven't already by clicking on the subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. And be sure to hit the like button too while you're down there. And also, if you're interested in signing up for our conference coming up on March 18th, which is a Saturday, just go to wealthion.com/conference. You can still lock in the early bird pricing. And finally, if the challenging macro outlook that Sven has detailed in this interview has you feeling a little vulnerable about the prospects for your wealth, then consider scheduling a free, no strings attached portfolio review by a financial advisor who can help manage your wealth, keeping in mind the trends and risks and opportunities that Sven has mentioned here. Just go to wealthion.com and we'll help set one up for you. Okay, I'll see you next in part two of our interview with Sven Henrich.